Well, thank you. Thank you, Glenn. Thanks to the band as well, and the PA, who have done a great job in setting me up with this cyborg-looking like contraption on my head. And also the projector, where Richard has assured me that he will bring up my slides just when they're meant to come up, even though he doesn't know what I'm going to say. I think that is an amazing gift. And thank you also for those who did the chairs. I'm on that rota, and I think every week people wouldn't be able to sit if you didn't have chairs. So thank you for that. So we've got this question: why do you call me Lord, Lord? It's a double thing. It's not just Lord, it's Lord, Lord, and do not do what I say. And the context is at the end of the Sermon of the Mount, or on the plain, rather oddly in Luke. Rather than saying Jesus was on a mountain, they said he went to a level place and preached a somewhat similar sermon to the one we find in Matthew's Gospel. But what is clear, he was speaking to a large crowd of disciples and also those that had been healed of their diseases. So I think it's fair to say it was a pretty eclectic mix of humanity. And Leanne described the whole range of types of people that would be in such a crowd. There were those who were seeking to follow, and there were those who were obviously seeking to get something from Jesus, to be healed, and there were, I'm sure, a lot of other hangers-on. And as I've said before, Jesus's question, it's sandwiched in between two word pictures, the picture of a good and bad tree and good and bad fruit, and also the parable of the wise and the foolish builders. When I looked at that question, I really felt uncomfortable. Initially, I just said, yeah, okay, I'll do one of the questions that you've got. And then I looked at this one and I thought, this is a really uncomfortable type of question to answer, because it cuts to the core of what it means to be being a disciple, a follower of Jesus. I like the Jewish idea of a disciple is a bit like an apprentice, where you have the father and the son, and they're growing up, and the father has a trade, and the son spends up till his teenage years or so learning the trade of his father, and then becomes an expert or in that trade. But up to that point, he's an apprentice, he's a disciple. And that's, in a sense, what we're called to be. We're called to copy, to imitate, to follow Jesus. And the question, I think, involves more than just some kind of mental assent to being a disciple, or even a confession, as we see here, Lord, Lord. It's not enough to call Jesus Lord. Immediately before the question, Jesus says that the mouth speaks of what the heart is full of. How can it be that godly-sounding words such as Lord, Lord have no bearing on our standing with God? Jesus makes a similar point in Matthew chapter 7, 21, where he says, not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but only the one who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. As I look at the question, it evokes various responses in me. Firstly, I might feel threatened. Next one. I might feel threatened by the question. We know that to do God's will is to do what God says. And I genuinely, maybe sincerely, want to do God's will. And I want God's will to be known to me. And I'm looking for some kind of revelation, maybe a formula that I can follow. But life gets in the way, and living life we experience as we experience it is not straightforward. We want this simple follow me ABC type of instruction to do God's will. But instead we discover or start to experience that as something mysterious, something hard to understand, maybe intractable. I might put the onus on God to deliver expect him to show me, and conclude that my responsibility is simply to knock, as we said in the song there, and we're knocking on the door and he's not answering. Maybe we need to knock harder. Maybe we need to try more. Maybe we need to do something to earn God's favor, and God suddenly says, yes, I'm going to let him know what my will is. And so God becomes a kind of remote and aloof kind of figure. You might even find him demanding. I might also feel guilt as I look at the question. It maybe appeals initially to my sense of having to earn God's favor or to earn Jesus' favor. Maybe there is something I can do. However, whatever my efforts are, I conclude I am not doing God's will, or maybe I haven't done it enough or done enough. Either way, I start to feel I'm falling short. I might try harder, or my response sadly might be, I've had enough, his demands are too much, I'll never find his favor, so I may as well give up. So I move on in life thinking that Jesus was a great, a wonderful teacher, probably the greatest teacher that ever lived, but I can't live up to his standards or his demands. Now, these responses are pretty negative, but I believe there is a third response, a third way to respond to Jesus' question, and I believe it leads to the best way, the best possible way to live. I believe that his question and the little word pictures we have of the wise and foolish builders and the good and the bad trees point me to the most satisfying and meaningful life there can be, the key to my deepest happiness and fulfillment. You know, we don't probably think of Jesus as a master psychologist, as the greatest psychologist that ever lived. Yet we say that Jesus is God and that he understands human nature better than anyone. And we can often turn to modern understandings of the human condition, and we readily apply them as if they held the keys to ultimate truth. And in our modern age, we have an abundance of self-help books. We have access to all kinds of podcasts, courses, knowledge, and almost every area of life and living. And these things, they have their place, and they can be of help. But the reality is, they are never going to satisfy our deepest needs and longings. And Jesus' question kind of pierces into our soul with this question, why do you not do what I tell you to do? Do we really believe that Jesus' life and words display the most awesome, the most wonderful, the most insightful, transcendent, and normal life that ever lived? He is the only normal person that has walked this earth. I like this quote by Stanley Jones, who was a missionary to India. God cannot guide you in any way that is not Christ-like. Jesus was supreme sanity. There was nothing psychopathic about him. He went off into no visions or dreams. He got his guidance through prayer, as you and I do. That is, he got his guidance when in control of his faculties, and not when out of control, as in dreams. I do not say that God may not guide through a vision or dream, but if he does, it will be very seldom, and it will be because we cannot get hold of our normal processes to guide them. God is found most clearly and beneficially in the normal rather than in the abnormal. And this is what I like. Jesus is the normal, for he is the norm. Our world is messed up because humanity is abnormal. I remember a while ago watching a documentary on TV talking about the kilogram and the problem that our modern world has in having a standard for the kilogram. I think it was in France for many, many years that the standard was. But they discovered that this kilogram was losing a number of atoms every year and therefore could not be used as the absolute standard to follow. And yet our modern world needs that. It needs standards and measures. Otherwise we don't function. Otherwise we start drifting apart. Things become a bit different. I want a kilogram of gold here in Britain to be the same as a kilogram of gold in Australia. How can I do that if I do not have an exact standard? And it's the same in our lives. Jesus is the norm. He's the only norm. And aligning our lives with Jesus' will bring us into the sphere of living in God's kingdom. Yet, what does Jesus, we still have that question, what does Jesus require us to do? I remember as a young man, it sounds funny to say that, but it's the only thing I can honestly say if you talk about something 45 years ago. But as a young man, I was on an outreach with Operation Mobilization in the summer of 1977. And it was in the north of France in a place called Lens. I don't know, those who speak French will know what's the right way to say it. And we were working, a small team of young people, working to try and evangelize North Africans who were working in the coal mines in North Africa. It was quite an amazing experience because they had these whole areas where there was nothing but North Africans. So we went around armed with simple Arabic phrases, Arabic literature, Bibles, New Testament, trying to share our faith with these people. And during our time there, an experienced older missionary came to help us. And some of you may know him. I didn't realize it until I read up about his background, but he was a Brethren missionary. His name was Charles Marsh, and he had worked for decades, 37 years, in Algeria and North Africa. And he would share about his experiences there in North Africa. And I remember him showing us a bunch of slides saying, first of all, the first 6 or 7 years, there was absolutely no response to his sharing the gospel to these largely nomadic tribal people. And then eventually, there was one or two people came and came to the Lord, and he would show these slides of these individuals. I don't know whether it was three or four of them. And then the next slide was the slide of the gravestones of these people, because as they came to the Lord, they were poisoned by their family and by the people that knew them. And they had no place to put them but in their own garden, because they were that fanatical about what they had done by turning away from Islam and coming to Christ. So one of his books is Too Hard for God, and that's it relates some of the story of his life, a remarkable life. And I was greatly challenged by the fact that this man could relate to North Africans in such an amazing way. In fact, he even said that there's a language for your toes. You can communicate to the people, the Berber people, or the Kabyle people, I think it was, by the way you you move your toes. And I was impressed by this man, and I thought, you know, I would go and ask him, what did he think? What would he say to me about what it means to do God's will? Because I was exercised about this. I wanted to know what God would have me do. But I wanted specifics. I wanted to know where I should go, what I should do, what were my gifts, a whole load of such questions. And I thought, he's the man to tell me all this. So I went, arranged to meet with him, and I sought his counsel. I said, how do I know the will of God? As I say, in the back of my mind, I was expecting him to say, I think you should go there and do this and do that. His response was simple, yet very profound, and it certainly wasn't what I expected. He looked at me and he said, in order to know God's will, you have to do it. And I was a bit perplexed. What did he mean? I needed to know God's will before I could do it. I felt I needed to know God's will before I could do it. And he's telling me, do it, and you will know God's will. He then rather, to my mind, quirkily said, pointed me to Romans 12, verses 1 and 2. And simply said, therefore I urge you, brothers and sisters, in view of God's mercy. This is what Paul is saying after all the wonderful things that God has done for us in Christ. He says, offer your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and pleasing to God. This is your true and proper worship. Don't conform to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Then you will be able to test and approve what God's will is, his good, pleasing, and perfect will. I like the Message version of that first verse, where it says, take your everyday, ordinary life, you're sleeping, you're eating, you're going to work, and you're walking around life, and place it before God as an offering. Embracing what God does for you is the best thing you can do for him. Then Charles Marcy said, now you need to just go away and go to a quiet place and do what Romans 12:1 says. He says, offer your body as a living sacrifice. He said, go through your whole body. It might take 30, 45 minutes. I guess with all the medics in our church here, it would take a lot longer. But start with your head, your mind, your brain, your eyes, your mouth, your ears, and then move down through each part of your body down to your toes and dedicate each part to God. Use your imagination, he said, as to how each part of your body could be offered as a sacrifice to him. At each point, say yes to his will for you. For your eyes, not to look on evil, to turn away from lust. Same with your mouth, with your speech, with your words, and so on. Now, you might think that offering yourself in that way means that you become no longer yourself. You lose your identity in some way, that you become some kind of robot that has given everything over. But no, the invitation is not like that. The invitation respects our autonomy and our freedom. We are called at every stage to choose. We have intention. God has given us intention. we are living sacrifices, not dead ones. And God respects our intention, our will, and we have great dignity in that, and he's asking us to use it. Now, I have to say that you might think that at the end of this story, suddenly a light came and suddenly everything was mapped out in front of me. It didn't need to a sudden and a clear revelation. I still had to wrestle with life. I still had to wrestle with my priorities, the things that I wanted to do. Was that what God wanted me to do? But what it did give was a fresh perspective that offering myself is the absolute best place to be. He calls us to be co-workers, and as a living sacrifice, we employ what we give to him, and in doing that, we start to discover, or as it said in the verse there, we start to test and approve what really is good, pleasing, and perfect about God's will. Now, as I said, that was a long time ago for me. I'm no longer young, and there are some here who have their lives in front of them. A good number of us here have less of our lives in front of us than we have lived. And everything is changing. Our minds and our intellects are changing throughout life. What I was 30, 45 years ago is not where I am today. How does that affect my faith? Am I leaning on some commitment from the past? Or is it a dynamic and a changing experience I have in relating to God? Those of us who are older now, we're called to worship God in that way. But with aging minds, with weakening bodies, even with fading memories, and also with our experience of life. Our will and our decisions are all part of a larger reality, something much larger than our understanding. God encompasses an infinitely larger space that we know nothing of. We cannot actually access it with our senses. When it comes to knowing and understanding God's will, it's a limited metaphor, but I like to think of it sometimes like passengers on a cruise liner. Imagine you were going from, I'm going to say London, Glasgow to New York, but I don't think there will be any liners going Glasgow to New York, but London to New York on a cruise liner. You all know your destination, New York, but on that liner, the 4 or 5 days that you spend on that liner, you have a whole variety of lives lived there, a whole variety of experiences. People who decide to spend all their time in the gym, others who decide they're going to spend all their time in the restaurant, some people in between, others reading books, others talking, and so it goes on. And yet, everybody arrives at New York. And it's as if God is giving us a freedom and an autonomy in how we live our lives, and yet he wants to bring us to that destination, that home, that eternal home that we all long for. The illustration that we have surrounding these verses is our powerful ones. Jesus invites us to hear. He illustrates that with the story of the wise and the foolish builders. And everyone is building something. Whether we serve God or not, we're all designed for meaning in our lives. We're all seeking it. Our actions show that. The actions of the wise and the foolish in this story might look exactly the same. The building might look, the edifice that's been built might look the same. Similarly, we can do the same things. We can attend church, we can go to Bible studies, we can take part in prayer times, we can volunteer, we can even become a missionary and serve in a variety of ways. We could become a key figure in the church and be respected for that. And our culture rewards diligence and conformity to social norms. We might even be perceived as a spiritual giant. Jesus said that some might prophesy, some might drive out demons and perform miracles. And yet, the almost paradoxical thing is that Jesus says, "I never knew them." The hard truth here is that Jesus teaches that some will be ruined by life's experiences and others will stand firm. The story of our lives can end well or it can end in disaster. I think as we look at the Sermon on the Mount, it's not a to-do list. It's not a list of things that we just tick off and say, "I've done that and now I'll do this," and so on. It's a description of what a life with Jesus in your heart would look like. It's the inner life that leads to the behaviors Jesus describes. We don't have time to go through the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew, but it's things, we've already made reference to it, in fact, last week. It's things like loving your enemies, not judging people, doing your prayers, your giving and your fasting in secret with no one but God knowing. It's asking, it's seeking, it's knocking. It's controlling our eyes, minds, emotions, and hearts, recognizing that adultery, lust, and murder begin there. It's being honest and it's being true with ourselves and in our relations with others. Not exaggerating. Let your yes be yes, Jesus says, and your no, no. No more, no less. Ask yourself, what kind of person do I need to become to behave like that? These behaviors are the fruit. People who live like that are recognized by their fruit. That's the story of the good trees. It's not possible to have a good heart and do evil. It's not possible either to have an evil heart and do good. The good that might be seen would be hypocrisy. Those that have good hearts do not need to advertise their goodness. The fruit is obvious to be seen and there for all to see. None of these things we can do in our own strength. It's only a heart transformed by having Jesus living in you. It requires effort. This is the story of the wise and foolish builders. It requires effort to hear what Jesus says, to pay attention. The digging required to build on the rock is not superficial. We have to dig deep. It involves sweat. It involves perspiration. We're not seeking to earn God's favor by doing this. This is simply God asking us to put effort in. I remember last year helping my brother-in-law erect a flagpole in Sweden. And you might think, I thought the flagpole is a fairly simple thing, just dig a hole and put the flagpole in the ground. No. Dig a very, very deep hole, get a very, very big metal box, and then you put the flagpole in the metal box, you fill it with dirt, and then you cover the whole thing over. The only way that flagpole would break is if it was snapped. So secure is the foundation. And that's what we are called to do with our lives. We're called to dig deep. Now, if what I've been saying all sounds too much, it is the work of a lifetime. Respond with whatever light you see. I like the paraphrase that the Message takes in the book of James. But whoever catches a glimpse of the revealed counsel of God, the free life, even out of the corner of his eye, and sticks with it, is no distracted scatterbrain, but a man and woman or woman of action. That person will find delight and affirmation in the action. Isn't that a wonderful picture? You maybe don't feel you see that much, but there'll be something out of the corner of your eye that you can act on. I want to finish with a lovely short poem by the Welsh priest and poet R.S. Thomas. I find he beautifully says things that are difficult to put into words. He awakens longing, a hunger for beauty and permanence, and he gives us a picture of the wonder and the preciousness of life, and also the unspeakable glory and joy that are promised in following Jesus. I'm going to read it, and I suggest we take this as our closing meditation. I've seen the sun break through to illuminate a small field for a while and gone my way and forgotten it. But that was the pearl of great price, the one field that had the treasure in it. I realize now that I must give all that I have to possess it. Life is not hurrying to a receding future, nor hankering after an imagined past. It's the turning aside, like Moses, to the miracle of the lit bush, to a brightness that seemed as transitory as your youth once, but is the eternity that awaits you.